applying the principles of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on Residential Schools to today's education system.
If that's the definition of cultural genocide, to prevent the transmission of values, then I can think of some things that are happening right now here in Canada in the education system that would fall under the category of cultural genocide.
On the feature interview today, a Christian school principal making the case that some governments are repeating some of the mistakes of the residential school debacle in the context of today's education. In the news, a potential new assault on religious freedom in Quebec, a look ahead to the annual ARPA fall tour, a bit of a different tour this year, and one man's successful campaign to change minds at two federal ministries.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
You may remember that a couple of years ago, the federal government scrapped a controversial section of the Canadian Human Rights Code, Section 13, which dealt with speech that was, quote, likely to expose a person to hatred or contempt. Well, now, the government of Quebec is moving in the opposite direction. They've introduced a bill to strengthen and expand the powers of Quebec's Human Rights Commission. ARPA lawyer Andre Schouten says the law has its origins in some political realities.
There's a sizable population in Quebec that's worried about religion, in particular the Muslim faith, but also other faiths, including Christianity. Secularism in Quebec is very different than in the rest of Canada. It's much more, well, ironically, it's much more religious. Secularism in Quebec is very religious. And so I think it's popular right now in Quebec to try to pass laws that limit religious freedom or look like they're cracking down on unreasonable religious extremism.
However, Schouten says, given the cultural context in Quebec, there could be some rather radical and unintended consequences of this new law as it applies to Christians and other faith groups.
I think what they have in mind is these radical Islamic communities, like the solemnization of marriage. So what they've done is they've removed parental consent for allowing a child to marry underage. And they've given that power now to the court, which in itself is kind of crazy. But I think what they have in mind is this idea of child brides and so on, which is particular to certain types of ethnic or religious communities. But the scary thing is that in a secular, radical secular society like Quebec, they'll just as easily apply this to reasonable Christian communities as well. And that's what kind of freaks me out about this. Same thing with the yanking of any sort of subsidy or even permits for private educational institutions. Again, they're probably thinking of radical Islamic schools where they're raising little jihadis or something. But the way that the Human Rights Commission interprets the Christian faith today, I wouldn't be surprised if they started using this kind of language and this kind of law to be yanking permits for schools like Loyola, for example.
The bill was introduced just before the National Assembly adjourned for the summer. It'll likely be up for debate this fall. A couple of legal updates to tell you about. Andre Schouten will be in Vancouver this week, one of three presenters invited to make oral arguments in defense of Trinity Western University's law school application in a suit against the Law Society of BC. In a similar vein, ARPA found out last week that we've been given leave to present oral arguments on essentially the same case in Nova Scotia. That hearing likely won't happen till next spring. And on the Carter case, on the last edition of Lighthouse News, we told you that a federal panel that's looking at a new euthanasia law would be taking public input online. That website went live late last week. We've got a link to it on the Lighthouse News homepage. If you're a longtime ARPA supporter, you'll know about our annual fall tour. This year, the tour has a different emphasis. Because it falls in the middle of the federal election campaign, the focus will be on the lack of abortion legislation in Canada. Mike Schouten with We Need a Law says if you attend one of the tour stops, you'll hear a different approach to the life issue, because what's been tried in the past there hasn't always worked all that well.
For example, I've been at many all candidates meetings, and someone will stand up and say, this is a question for all the candidates. Canada allows abortion right through until 9 months of pregnancy. What are you going to do about this? This needs to end in our country. This is such an embarrassment. Babies are dying, and these are all true statements. But you're not providing the candidate an opportunity even to give a good answer, something that you can go away with and say, okay, I know where he or she stands. Normally the answer will be, well, as you know, Mr. Harper has said, or our party believes in women's rights, so that's a women's rights issue and we're not going to take those away.
So, Schouten says, instead of that usual way of doing things, the focus of the tour will be to educate voters on ways to bring up three specific abortion-related topics during the election campaign. He says it's part of a deliberate strategic move to get the issue on the table in a way that'll get more people engaged.
We believe strongly in an incremental approach, and if we're ever going to push back against the status quo and get any political victories, we're going to have to start with things that Canadians have in common. Preborn victims of crime, sex selective abortion, and this whole notion of fetal pain, so abortions after 20 weeks gestation, that resonates with Canadians.
And for the first time, this will truly be a national tour. Nikki Pennings is coordinating the schedule.
Our first trip is to the East Coast, stops in Moncton, Charlottetown, and Halifax. That's from September 23rd to 25th. Then we head back to Ontario with a stop at the University of Ottawa and a press conference on Parliament Hill. We head to Southern Ontario for September 28th to October 2nd. Then we drive west and we stop in Sault Ste. Marie and Thunder Bay before we make it to the prairies. Then we'll be in Manitoba and Saskatchewan October 8th to 13th and Alberta and BC from October 14th to 17th.
Complete details on a new website set up just for this purpose. It's at lifetour.ca. We've got a link up from our homepage as well. And one thing more, we've all heard the old phrase that you can't fight City Hall. Well, an Ontario man has gone one better than that. He's fought two federal bureaucracies, health and justice, and he's won. This is about the Supreme Court's 2004 ruling on corporal punishment, spanking. In that ruling, the court allowed for corporal punishment in certain circumstances as long as the force was, quote, reasonable. There have been various campaigns since then to have the criminal code changed anyway, and it appears some federal bureaucrats might have been a little bit on board with those campaigns. Harold Hoff noticed some statements on the Federal Justice Ministry's website and in some brochures put out by Health Canada.
For example, why doesn't spanking work? Experts say that spanking is not an effective form of discipline. Spanking can make children angry and resentful. It can cause them to lose trust in their parents. It teaches them that hitting others is okay. In the long run, it can make children's behavior worse, and it doesn't work for you or the child. A lot of these things have been scientifically and empirically proven false with a large amount of real-time data. I did a study myself, which took 2 years and I published last fall.
Mr. Hoff published his findings in a book. We've got a link to that from our website. And then he took that research to the federal government. It took a long time, but the offending statements are now gone from the government's website, and the brochures have been mostly rewritten.
The government isn't just going to listen to some person, so I actually did this through the help of my member of parliament. He helped me get the material, the research, and my cover letters pointing out where the problems were or where the false editorializing was, handed directly to the Minister of Justice and the Minister of Health so that it could go down the chain from there to whoever handles the websites and the publications. And that process took about a year, and I've now noticed that the Department of Justice website has been updated and certain comments have now been removed. In the same token, the Health Canada agency has updated this pamphlet. I still call it a propaganda pamphlet because there's still false statements in it, but at least they've updated it and toned down the language and removed a few of these completely false statements.
He says his story is proof that if you're persistent, the Canadian political system does actually work. Back with more after this.
Every 2 weeks, beginning August 26th, we will be producing short election guides that will equip our listeners in matters pertaining to the election. We will cover such topics as euthanasia, sexuality, and family policy, and help you understand where each party stands on the various issues. All election 2015 resources, including past articles on abortion and reviewing the 41st Parliament, can be viewed at arpacanada.ca. Find a link on our homepage or go directly to arpacanada.ca/election-2015. These resources are great to print out and share with friends as you discuss the upcoming election.
And we're back on the program. On the line with me today is Kent Dykstra. Kent is the principal of William of Orange Christian School in Surrey, BC. He wrote a provocative little piece on the ARPA website a little while ago entitled Public Education Cultural Genocide. First of all, Kent, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Al.
Your report was written shortly after the release of the Truth and Reconciliation Report on the residential school system in Canada. First question, I guess, is why? What prompted you to write this?
Well, you know, you read the newspaper and you read the very different accounts of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, especially in the National Post. There were a wide variety of opinions expressed, and it gets a guy thinking. I guess what happened was I started to think about it on my own and in my own context, in my own educational context, and whether or not there are any parallels or applications to the field of education when it comes to the issue of historical wrongs in the residential school system. And I believe there are.
You know, you draw some parallels between that system as it's critiqued in the Truth and Reconciliation Report and the reality today with respect to the way Christian parents are treated in the public system, particularly with respect to the notion of cultural genocide. I'd like you to expand on that. That's really the basis of what you're writing there.
Well, if you read the accounts of the report, one of the controversial aspects of the report was the definition of cultural genocide. And if I could quote from the report, it says, "Cultural genocide is the destruction of those structures and practices that allow a group to continue as a group. Specifically, families are disrupted to prevent the transmission of cultural values and identity from one generation to the next." Now, of course, the report applies this to the practice of residential schooling that took place during the last 1.5 centuries here in Canada. But I got to thinking, wait a minute, if that's the definition of cultural genocide, to prevent the transmission of values, then I can think of some things that are happening right now here in Canada in the education system that would fall under the category of cultural genocide.
Such as?
Well, let's take a look at some of the legislation that has just been passed in Alberta regarding the gay-straight alliance groups, or take a look at some of the sexual education curriculum that's being proposed in Ontario. I mean, the governments there are trying to prevent the transmission of cultural and religious values from parents to children by doing an end run in the classroom. To me, if you're going to use that definition of cultural genocide, that's precisely what it is.
One line from your piece really stood out for me. You wrote that, I'm quoting here, "The same assumptions that produce the residential school system are alive and well in Canada today, specifically the assumption that government knows best when it comes to the education of our children." What I take from that is that this whole discussion really goes to presuppositions and worldviews about education. How do we right this ship in terms of bringing some balance back to this?
You know, at base, Al, it comes back to core beliefs. And the only way to really right that ship is to challenge and change people's core beliefs. I'm a Christian school educator, so at root, I believe that it's really the gospel that's going to change people's presuppositions and worldviews. But of course, here in Canada, we have a political system that allows us a free flow of ideas. That's one of the great blessings about living in Canada today. And we as citizens also need to make sure that our voice and our views are being heard, even if it's not necessarily going to convince others, but at least let people know what our views are. And I think ARPA is an ideal vehicle for things like this. ARPA makes it really easy for us as citizens.
ARPA's support base generally recognizes, I think, the sort of philosophical concept of the primary role of parents in education. And you seem to infer, and I wouldn't disagree, that government sometimes oversteps its bounds here. But equally, I would ask, what is a legitimate role for government in this area? Do we, for example, give them the right to set some objective academic standards so that we can all have confidence that when a kid gets out of grade 12, they have a certain knowledge base that's universally agreed to? What is the legitimate role for government in the governance of this educational sector?
Not all people would necessarily agree on the answer to that question. But for me, I appreciate the role of government, especially here in BC. I compare the role of government here in BC to some of the other provinces, and I know that we, in many ways, live under a less oppressive system than especially folks in Ontario. And there's a couple of examples. We do get some funding from government, and that's a role of government that we value. The other role of government that you alluded to was to set parameters on a body of knowledge that all graduates should know. I think our government here in BC strikes a fairly good balance at that. What they're trying to do is make sure that the outcomes that they want are broad enough that we as a Christian school can make sure that our worldview comes across to our students while we're still meeting the requirements of government.
Final question. I want to go back to this context of what you call cultural genocide. What are some practical things that Christian parents can do to ensure that their culture, which really is far more than just culture, it goes to the deeply held presuppositions and worldviews, but what can Christian parents do to ensure that those convictions, those cultural things, are passed on to the next generation within the context of this increasing attack on the ability to do that by setting all kinds of different standards in the education system, as is happening in Ontario and Alberta?
You know, I would say, as a parent, one of the biggest things that you can do is belong to a community that shares your culture, shares your religion, shares your worldview. And that's one of the reasons why I think not only the church, but also Christian schooling, or more broadly, independent schooling, is so valuable and vital. Here in BC, we have quite a vibrant independent school scene. We have Muslim schools, we have Sikh schools, we have a lot of Christian schools. And those are prime vehicles that parents can use to pass on their culture to their kids. That's more of a corporate way. But of course, we as parents can't leave it to the churches and schools. We have to be careful as parents and work hard as parents to make sure that we have the right conversations with our kids, not just about their personal choices, but also about their history, their background, their heritage, what they are called to do, in our case as Christians, what their role is in the world, and especially what is their role in a democracy, what is their role here in Canada. And those conversations are vital as parents and children.
I saw a quote online a little while ago from Vodi Bakum. He says, if parents turn their children over to Caesar for education, they shouldn't be surprised when those kids come back as Romans.
Yeah. I'm smiling. I've heard that quote many times. That is so true.
Kent, we're out of time. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Al. It's been a pleasure.
Just a programming note to wrap up. For the summer, Lighthouse News has been brought to you twice a month, every other week. Starting with the next program on Labor Day Monday, we'll be back to our regular weekly schedule.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Production manager, Brian Grimm. Technical director, Nate Boscher. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpacanada.ca. Be sure to join us again next month for another edition of Lighthouse News.